Good afternoon. We call the Senate Resource Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 1st, already 2023, and the time is 3:23 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Co-chair Giesel's present. Myself, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Klayman, and Senator Kawasaki, Senator Dunbar, and Senators Kaufman should be joining us momentarily. Today, I want to like to thank our support staff, Carrie Cooperetter and Amanda Kraft. First hearing will be on SB 67, PFAS use in firefighting, sponsored by Senator Keel. Then we will have a brief at ease and change out our presenters and set the slide deck and get set for our mining overview. And first up, Senator Keel and Ms. Slinghide, staff to Senator Keel. So the floor is yours, and I believe we have two invited testifiers today as well.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of serving Senate District B here in northern southeast Alaska. With me today is Kathy Schlingheide, who works in my office. Senate Bill 67 is, as the title suggests, about PFAS. And in the past, when talking about PFAS, we have provided the committee with several dozen pages of scientific information describing PFAS, its health effects. I elected to spare you that reading material in favor of an oversimplified description. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are referred to as a group as PFAS. They are substances, the chemical signature of which is a fully fluorinated carbon atom. And here's the key. Carbon-fluorine bonds are among the strongest atomic bonds that we have out there. And that makes them extremely resistant to being broken. If you make a firefighting foam with PFAS substances with fully fluorinated carbon atoms in there, the heat of the fire won't break down your foam. It's really effective at putting stuff out. It's also going to last long, long, long beyond the fire at hand. PFAS are colloquially known as forever chemicals. Sunlight doesn't particularly break them down. Heat doesn't particularly break them down. Nothing biological particularly breaks them down. They just stick around, or worse, they bioaccumulate. They're also really bad for you. Again, in the interest of sparing the committee long and detailed scientific descriptions, PFAS chemicals at extremely low concentrations have a variety of really bad health effects on human beings. They are closely associated with a number of cancers, especially testicular and kidney cancer, a number of bad liver effects. They are closely associated with low birth weight, as well as preeclampsia and other problems in pregnant women. They suppress the immune system and immune response to vaccines. There are other negative health effects. And I have to stress again, at extremely low concentrations, parts per trillion, or in recent EPA guidance, parts per quadrillion. They're in all kinds of things, but the primary way they impact Alaskans today is getting into the drinking water after firefighting foams containing PFAS have been sprayed. There's no big bad evildoer here. No one has been irresponsible or nasty with these things. Because they're so effective at fighting fires, the Federal Aviation Administration has for a long time required, if you can land a jet at an airport, you need to have PFAS-containing foams just in case there's a fire. The FAA has also required that you test your equipment and train with it where you would fight the fire, and that includes out on the runway. Once the foam's on the runway, it washes to the water table. If there's a drinking water well down gradient, we have a problem. And in place after place after place around Alaska, we have a problem. Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, what I'd love to bring you today is a bill dealing with the cleanup of these substances once they're in people's drinking water. That technology doesn't exist yet. Not effectively, not to parts per trillion or parts per quadrillion. when people's drinking water is contaminated with PFAS chemicals, the solution today in the midterm is to bring them alternate drinking water from some clean source. The state of Alaska and the federal government, depending on who did the spraying, has run municipal water lines miles and miles to people's homes, has installed cisterns and brought in trucked water from clean sources, and brought in bottled water in some situations so that people have clean water to drink, to bathe with, to cook with. It is absolutely essential, given that there isn't yet a good way to clean it up, to prevent any future spills that could get into Alaskans' drinking water. That brings us, hopefully that's a good replacement for several dozen pages of scientific documents. That brings us to Senate Bill 67, Mr. Chairman. The bill, at its most fundamental essence, says no new spraying of PFAS-containing firefighting foams. No new discharges of this stuff into Alaska's environment. Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of small exceptions, but I think they're important to discuss with the committee. At the moment, and for a little while longer, the FAA maintains its requirement. Thus, a prohibition on spraying PFAS-containing foams would be federally preempted. The bill simply acknowledges that. The good news is that the FAA is expected soon to do away with its requirement. It actually has a congressional mandate to lift that requirement, and the United States military has military specifications for fluorine-free foams, non-toxic foams. And several products are in the process of being identified that meet those mil specs. That, I think, is a precursor to the FAA lifting its requirement, at which point this bill will be effective for all Alaska airports. The other issue is the oil and gas industry. Mr. Chairman, there are great fluorine-free alternatives for things like fighting an aircraft fire, fighting significant vehicle fires that have hydrocarbons. But when you get to the quantities of hydrocarbons that you have in the oil and gas industry, think about a tanker. Think about the storage tanks at the Valdez tanker terminal. There are not yet fluorine-free foams that will do the job. They're close. Research by the industry, by academics, research is going on now, and there are fluorine-free products that get very close to completely putting out large oil and gas fires. What the bill says is that once those products are available and certified as effective, the state fire marshal, I tried to find the least political person I could who would have significant expertise, the state fire marshal will, by regulation, mark the transition for the oil and gas industry. That will be the full usual regulatory process. The industry will have the ability to talk about timeframes and transition so that there is a reasonable and responsible approach. Mr. Chairman, there's one more element of this bill I need to flag for the committee. That's a take-back provision. The bill requires the executive branch to take back up to 25 gallons of concentrate of PFAS-containing foam. There are small volunteer fire departments, especially little rural departments, that have a code red cart that you can pull behind a four-wheeler that has a canister, a few gallons of this poisonous foam. It is imperative that that foam be disposed of appropriately and safely. And tiny volunteer fire departments in remote rural villages do not generally have the resources to send it off to hazmat landfills, to warehouse it until such time as some sort of effective PFAS destruction technology can prove up. So the bill does require that the executive branch take that back. It is my expectation, although I want to be clear, I cannot speak for DOTPF, that that will be put together with the 30-some thousand gallons of PFAS-containing foams that the state airport system owns, and that disposal will be handled en masse in an appropriate way. Mr. Chairman, that is Senate Bill 67. It is, at its essence, a no more PFAS pollution bill. I'm happy to take questions. If you have technical issues, my staff has degrees I don't and can actually answer them.
Committee members, questions? Okay, Ms. Linghai, would you walk us through this section?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kathy Schlingheid, staff to Senator Keel. Section 1 of the bill adds a new section in law. 340A prohibits new spraying of PFAS-containing foam unless preempted by federal law or used by those in the oil and gas industry. 340B allows those in the oil and gas industry to continue using PFAS-containing foams until an alternative is approved by regulation. 340C allows the state fire marshal to write regulations when there are safe fluorine-free foams for use in the oil and gas industry. 340D requires the executive branch to take up to 25 gallons per year of PFAS-containing firefighting foam from small users. And Section 2 of the bill adds an effective date.
Questions? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Do we have reason to believe that there are safe alternative firefighting substances available?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, yes. Yes. In everything except the size and intensity of fires that we might encounter at large oil and gas production and storage facilities, almost the entirety of Europe has been fluorine-free for many years. The fluorine-free foams in use at Gatwick and Heathrow and Frankfurt airports are more than effective and are plenty effective enough for the large volumes of air traffic that go through Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the jets that land anywhere else in Alaska.
Follow up, just curious, are we still using PFAS at major airports here in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Wilikowski's question, as of today, the Federal Aviation Administration still requires it of DOT. So the answer is yes. Although, Mr. Chairman, let me add, DOT is not testing it out on the runways at this point. They meet their requirements to test and train in contained systems so that the PFAS foam does not escape into the environment today. Obviously, were there a fire, that's a different story.
Senator Giesel.
Yes, Senator Keel, so firefighters themselves must be at risk of exposure to this. I mean, I read, we got a document about PFAS. It was rather thick brochure, and it mentioned that in the older ski waxes, PFAS was an element, and actually in Norway, folks that skied a lot had higher blood levels of PFAS. It was very interesting. So the firefighters must be exposed too. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Giesel, yes, that is absolutely the case. Our first responders have often been exposed to significant PFAS quantities. It is present in a lot of things. It, as you might imagine from its chemical properties, it makes things nonstick. It makes things fire resistant. It makes things waterproof. All of those it does very well. Those things are concerning. Senate Bill 67 focuses on the things that can get into our drinking water. Frankly, you know, there are some legacy unlined landfills in the state of Alaska, and their leachate, I would guess, is a significant PFAS contamination problem. As far as I'm aware, nobody's got a drinking water well right downslope of a landfill. if they do, they have other problems. So this bill focuses on the single greatest threat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kawasaki and then Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me the airports like in Europe use a non-PFAS firefighting foam? Is there much of a difference in cost between the two in Europe? And is there a definite cost here in the United States that doesn't frequently use it?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Kawasaki, I do not have a cost comparison. The good news is that there are manufacturers around the world who make fluorine-free foams that work. And so when those products are approved through the Navy's mil-spec process, I won't pretend to be an expert. We won't be having everyone in America trying to buy the very first gallon from a new manufacturer. There are existing and established manufacturers on the planet.
Super. Thank you.
Senator Klayman.
Do you have more about the timeline to when the non-PFAS-containing fire retardants will be approved by, is it the Navy that's going to approve them?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Klayman, that process is expected to be, I believe, a 60 to 90 day process. It has begun for some products. That should, and I'm speaking advisedly here, that should trigger the FAA. The United States Congress gave the FAA a deadline to lift its requirement that there be fluorinated foams at all airports. We are well past that deadline, which I find remarkable. However, I think that we are looking at probably a 3 to 4 month window, and then I believe, although I cannot make you a promise about the federal government, I believe the FAA will begin its process to lift its requirement.
Follow up, would that be, I'm not holding you to guarantees or anything else, but does that sounds like we could potentially expect this to have occurred within the next 6 to 12 months?
Yes, Mr. Chair, in response to Senator Klayman, the FAA is saying that they are planning to remove the requirement for fluorinated foams in 3 to 4 months.
Within what?
Within 3 to 4 months, the FAA says they're going to act.
Further questions? Are you telling the committee we should keep using our cast iron skillets?
Mr. Chairman, I use my cast iron skillet just about every chance I get.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, we're going to go to invited testimony, and our first testifier is Justin Mack, Secretary Treasurer of Alaska Professional Firefighters Association of Anchorage. Good afternoon. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, please put yourself on the record in 3 minutes, please.
That's good. For the record, my name is Justin Mack, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association. We represent over 500 fire and EMS professionals. I'm speaking in support of SB 67. In addition to serving in union leadership, I've been employed with the Municipality of Anchorage for 12 years and currently serve as a fire captain. For the most part, being a firefighter is a unique but routine job. We study and do tours of the station, we give station tours, we provide community outreach, we respond to medical calls and fire alarms. The job is routine until it's not. When the tones go off at 2 a.m. and 3 or 4 minutes later, we find ourselves in a building we've never been in with heavy smoke and fire all around and zero visibility. The calls are routine until the report of victims trapped in multifamily structure, and you and your crew are the difference between whether or not these victims will see another day. While these calls are anything but routine, it is the career we have chosen and the one that we love to do. We all know that this career can be dangerous. It is simply not safe to run into a burning building. Early in my career, I learned that through good training and tactics, we could keep ourselves safe. What I failed to understand is that no matter how careful we are, and even if we follow every known standard operating guideline, even if we do the absolute best decon of ourselves and equipment, and even if we wear the most up-to-date PPE, we will be exposed to some of the worst chemicals on Earth. These chemicals permeate through our gear, make their way into our pores, and linger. It is the reason that after a significant structure fire, you can smell it for days. Study after study shows that firefighters have significant increase in cancer rates when compared to the general population. Firefighters are excellent problem solvers. When faced with the cancer problem, we attack it head on. The journey to solve this problem has forced us to look at the equipment we purchase, the tactics we use, and the very PPE we wear. The more we look, the more we find that our exposure to a career of firefighting is literally carcinogenic. The World Health Organization now classifies the occupation of firefighting as carcinogenic, the highest grouping classification available. The profession of firefighting is in the same group as diesel exhaust fumes, radiation, and tobacco smoke. SB 67 is an attempt to limit exposure of known carcinogens to firefighters and the community, and the Alaska professional firefighters fully support this effort. This bill allows for industry and federal standards to find a balance when working with PFAS. Firefighters typically use PFAS in AFFF foam when dealing with flammable liquids fires. We refer to these as Class B fires and AFFF foam as Class B foam. This bill would likely force departments to reevaluate the products we use and strategy and tactics we use on Class B fires. The inconvenience or cost of implementing this bill needs to be weighed against the exposure to firefighters and the community. There are alternatives to PFAS-containing foam available on the market, and there is a mechanism built into this bill to allow discretion through the State Fire Marshal's office. SB 67 is a step in the right direction in advocating for public safety members and local communities, and is balanced with reasonable exceptions and thoughtful language. Strongly urge support of SB 67.
Okay, seeing no questions from committee members, thank you for calling in today. Next, we're going to go to Mayor David Pruse. Mr. Mayor Fairbanks, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes, I am, Senator. Thank you very much. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senator Keel's Senate Bill number 67. As you all know, Fairbanks, the interior of Alaska, has an extensive problem with PFAS and its distribution. The city of Fairbanks has spent $5.4 million extending a private utility's water system into areas that were polluted by PFAS from a firefighter training center that never failed. The system never failed, but the foam was sprayed outside the area where the containment was. So over 20, 30 years, it migrated 2.5 miles northwest by northwest, and we spent $5.4 million installing water to 74 homes. We also have an issue with our water sewer system when they have concentrate discharge of basically mud, same as what Juneau experiences. And Juneau takes their contaminated waste and they ship it outside at an expense of approximately $3 million a year, according to their city mayor that I talked with last week in Juneau. The city of Fairbanks, at its last meeting on Monday, we did a resolution authorizing the city of Fairbanks to submit project questionnaires on behalf of Golden Heart Utilities for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Clean Water State Revolving Fund in the amount of $1,500,000 for a biosolids incinerator pilot testing project. We've always been proactive up here looking at things, but as Senator Keel said, some utilities or some municipalities have put in miles and miles of water line to protect their citizens, and Fairbanks is one of those areas. And anything to alleviate this problem, I believe Senator Keel is very correct when you have to remove the contaminant from the system. That's where you start. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And that concludes our invited testimony. Is there anything else before we set this bill aside today from committee members? Seeing none, we're going to set this bill aside. Thank you, Senator and Ms. Slinghide, for presenting. We're going to take it brief at ease while we get our next presenters up. Okay, we're back on the record. Now we're coming to the presentation I've been waiting for 40 days. So. Please proceed. We have, before we get started, we have Kieran Mathias, Executive Director, Council of Alaska Producers, Deantha Skibinski, Executive Director, Alaska Miners Association, Mr. Satry, Governmental Affairs for Hecla Limited. So welcome to the committee, and I'll watch the committee at the end of each slide, see if there's any questions. I've looked through it. It looks good. So thank you. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Deantha Skibinski. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association, and you'll be hearing from these folks first, so I'll turn it over to them.
For the record, Karen Mathias, Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers.
And for the record, my name is Mike Satry. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for Hecla Mining Company, but more importantly, I'm a Southeast kid who grew up here in Juneau, and the mining industry was able to bring me home and live in a place that I truly love. I want to start this presentation off with a safety share. It's how we start our meetings off in the mining industry, and you know, similar to other resource industries that you know value the health and safety of our employees above all else. Two weeks ago, at our operation here in Alaska, at Greens Creek here in Juneau, we had three of our employees were working doing some standard operations around loading a truck, and as they were finishing up the job, one of the employees was noticed to be leaning on the truck trailer and maybe not quite doing right, and so his colleague said, hey, you doing okay? And the guy looked up and said, no, I'm not. And you know, that's something to admit. You know, we're always, you know, doing our jobs, we're hard pressed to get things done, and to admit that something's not quite right is important. So our team is trained, and they immediately made a phone call to our medic, who was about a mile up the road at our medic station, brought him down there, and it was immediately obvious that the gentleman in question was in some sort of, you know, cardiac distress. So they got him up to the medic's station, immediately started trying to alleviate the symptoms, and he went into cardiac arrest. Chest compression started, AED came out, able to shock him back into rhythm. Life was good, got him into Juneau, got him to Anchorage, and, you know, thankfully the person is doing extremely well right now. So a couple things to take away from that. One, you know, it's great that when you're at an operation like ours, we have well-prepared medics, EMTs throughout the staff, mine rescue teams that are able to recognize a situation and rectify it right away. Hopefully, you know, we all can live and work in situations like that. But the other thing is to, you know, if things aren't feeling right, you're feeling faint, have a sense of doom, maybe just things are weighing on you more than normal, dizzy, nauseous, call your doctor, call a health provider, make sure that you're checking yourself out. It's just, it's so easy for us to live and work in stressful situations and try to push through things, ask for help, but more importantly, look to see if your colleagues need some help and give them that help they need or give them that push to seek medical assistance. And then hopefully, like this gentleman, like our operation, everyone can walk away healthy and alive and ready to see their families at the end of the day. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Karen to start our presentation.
For the record, Karen Mathias. This presentation has three parts. First, I'll cover the global outlook, the soaring demand for minerals to meet the need for more renewable technologies and energy storage, the increasing nonpartisan concern about the U.S. overdependence on mineral imports being a threat to our national security and to our economy, and the agreement that more domestic production is needed. Alaska has the mineral resource potential, and we embody the principles of ESG. We should leverage these assets. So DEAMP is going to talk about the Alaska's environmental standards, as well as the community partnerships with local mines and also the local benefits that accrue from those. And then in conclusion, Mike will answer the question of why we don't have more mines in Alaska and how we can position Alaska to be more competitive in this global industry. So the top image there on the left-hand side is of the house and the minerals that are used in daily life. We've given a version of this message many times over the years with different pictures. The more, you know, the bottom line is that everything we use is either made of minerals or it was grown or transported to us using metals and minerals. But if you go to the lower image on the left-hand side, you see the reality that new technologies are more mineral intensive. And the example that's given here is cell phones. So the first generation cell phones, you see the periodic table and the orange squares are the minerals that are in that particular early stage cell phone. Move over to smartphones and you see the periodic table is, you know, almost completely colored with all of the minerals that are used in that device. And I would reckon that you all have one in your pocket with all of those minerals. But if you move to the right-hand side image, you see that there's enormous increases for specific minerals just in the production of electric vehicles. Among the minerals that are listed in that list, and it's probably a bit difficult for you to see from here, but most importantly, we saw zinc, silver, copper, cobalt, and graphite. Zinc and silver are already produced in Alaska. In fact, we have the nation's largest zinc and silver mines in our state. We also have the other minerals, copper, cobalt, and graphite, in resources that could be produced here by projects that are already in development. And this isn't just an industry view. International organizations like the World Bank and the International Energy Agency have published reports outlining the increasing demand. There's also growing awareness that not all countries are enforcing health and safety regulations and sound environmental practices. For an example of that, we can look specifically at cobalt. Cobalt's used in lithium batteries, which are used in our smartphones, in electric vehicles, the airbags of your cars, in airplane parts, and lots of other things. Most cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Of the 255,000 Congolese miners,
an estimated 40,000 are children, some as young as 6 years old. Frankly, child labor to produce minerals for our cell phones is unacceptable. So as demand for all minerals grows, countries and companies need to commit to responsibly sourced production and processing. It's often asked, you know, well, how about recycling? Is recycling the solution? And recycling and reuse is definitely important. There should be a lot more research into safer and more efficient ways to recycle minerals. But recycling is only a small part of the solution. The World Bank report notes that even if we were to double the current recycling rates of copper and aluminum, it would still not be enough to meet the estimated demand for new renewable energy technologies and energy storage. So what are we going to do? Well, the U.S. Geological Survey produces an annual list of minerals the country needs, but the supply of which is not secure. However, it's almost ironic because the U.S. actually has massive mineral resources that we're not producing. And it seems almost absurd that we are importing these minerals when we could be producing them here at home. Instead, as you can see on this slide, we've allowed China to dominate the supply chain, particularly in processing. But China's involvement in extraction is also actually greater than is apparent given on that slide. I spoke previously about cobalt, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo is listed as the major extraction country for cobalt, but the reality is that 15 of the 17 industrial operations for cobalt mining in the Congo are owned by China. So China has invested heavily in mines in other countries and is more dominant in extraction than that slide even shows us.
I'd just like to make a point. We could get to net zero by 2050 faster with carbon if we would mine our own materials instead of materials in foreign countries that probably have no intention of getting to zero carbon by 2050.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. The fact is, the concern about China is not a fringe theory. There's bipartisan recognition that America's increasing dependence on China and other countries is a threat to national security and to our economy. President Biden has issued a number of executive orders in 2020, one that addressed the threat to domestic supply chains and supporting domestic mining. In 21, ordering a review of our supply chains, and then in 22, announcing major investments to expand the domestic critical minerals supply chain. Our U.S. senators agree and have repeatedly pointed out that we have extensive resources in Alaska. Increasing domestic mineral production would reduce our dependence on other countries and ensure that minerals are produced under the highest environmental and safety and labor standards. So this is a map of current mining and operations and projects in Alaska. We have an excellent track record. We have five large mines that were all developed after the passage of modern environmental laws, including the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which, as you know, requires federal agencies to assess the environmental impacts when considering permit applications. So on the back of that map that you have in front of you, there is a little bit of information about each mine. Just given the amount of time we have today, we're not going to walk through every operation and project. But we're happy to answer questions if you have any. But I'm going to hand it over now to Diantha to talk about the environmental regulations.
Well, thank you again for the record. Diantha Skabinski, Alaska Miners Association. So Karen gave us the global picture of our dependency on minerals and how that is certainly going to increase in the near and long-term future. And I'd like to tell you today why Alaska is the right place to look and see how we can further contribute to the mineral supply chain. As Karen mentioned, in Alaska, we do mining right. Mines in our state are permitted under strict environmental policies that aren't just designed for operational success, but they're also designed for closure and reclamation of the land, and financial assurance is required. The regulatory regime in which mining activity takes place ensures that the environment here is protected and in many cases enhanced, and I'll provide some examples of that in a moment. So once a mine completes the intensive process of securing anywhere from 40 to 70 permits to mine and it begins the operations, there is thorough oversight by our regulatory agencies. Mines are inspected multiple times per year, and the mines must report hundreds of actions to prove they are complying with their permits. And so I'd like to get into something that I know is dear to all of us, which is water quality. Alaska has one of the best water quality monitoring systems in the world. Like many advanced countries, we require the company to monitor water quality in the streams and the groundwater downstream of the mine, but Alaska goes further than just doing that water quality monitoring. We do biomonitoring, which looks at the health of the downstream ecosystem, so from the bottom of the food chain to the top. The purpose here is to detect any issues long before they become a problem and to assess whether the permit standards are adequate to protect the environment. Biomonitoring reviews the health of the fish populations and the habitat, and it determines whether juvenile fish, the most sensitive, are absorbing any metals. Biomonitoring also includes the benthic environment, the bottom of the water body bed, what fish eat, and also algae composition. And then we monitor the process itself. So every 5 years, a third-party audit audits both the mine's compliance and the regulatory agencies. This is all publicly available information, and the public has opportunities to suggest what it believes should be looked into. This level of monitoring is above and beyond what even most developed countries do to review a mine's environmental performance. Alaska really is a world leader in monitoring the effects of mining on the environment, and it's a system we can really be proud of. So I mentioned I would show some examples and cases in which mining has enhanced the environment. So we'll start with this look at Red Dog Creek. You can see in the photo on the left, this is upstream from the mine, the red staining of the water in the banks from the naturally occurring mineralization that is there. So prior to any mining development in the area, the entire creek was dominated by sandbars and it had very little vegetation along its banks and very little aquatic life. Today, the treated water downstream from the mine meets water quality standards and it's resulted in abundant vegetation and fish populations. And on the right, you can see those changes from a regulatory perspective. These are the water quality standards that were reported to EPA, with the zinc levels, again, at the beginning here, naturally occurring at the site long before mining entered the picture, several times higher than what exists today with the water treatment that happens at Red Dog.
I'd like to just make a note for my colleagues. That's one of the tip-offs for the discovery of that Red Dog property was this water source.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right. That is how they figured out that there was a pretty impressive mineral deposit there. So now looking at Fort Knox, right around the Fort Knox mine, historic placer mining in the neighboring vicinity had left a landscape of exposed permafrost and isolated ponds. And although it wasn't an area that Fort Knox had operated in, they joined with the Department of Fish and Game to rehabilitate the area. They constructed stream channels to connect all of those ponds and provide fish passage, and added shrubs and willows to build wildlife habitat. And it resulted in a fish and wildlife sanctuary. You can see the moose really love the area. There is prize-sized grayling. And at the time of performing the restoration, working together, the agency targeted to reach the goal of fish size and quantity at the end of Fort Knox's mine life. And they reached it in 2 years. It's a really great success story. And the Department of Fish and Game and Fort Knox jointly received environmental awards for this work. Here on the screen, you can see a fish passage project that was done by the Greens Creek Mine. The fish pass was proposed in the mine's original environmental impact statement as a mitigation measure to offset impacts from mine development and to improve the anadromous fish habitat around the mine. Later, there was a change in the mine plan with the tailings pile, and the projected impact was dramatically reduced to really only a half acre of habitat. But despite that, the mine honored its commitment to the regulatory agencies and in 1989 constructed three weirs in Greens Creek
to navigate the falls area and access an additional 3 miles of Greens Creek that was previously inaccessible to the fish and provided more optimal habitat. Monitoring in the 90s and the early 2000s showed a growing fish population demonstrating the success. However, an intense storm event in 2005 destroyed one of the timber weirs and significantly damaged the others. In 2016, Greens Creek set out to repair the fish pass, which took extensive technical design for longevity. And because it's in a remote location within the Admiralty Island National Monument, all the work had to be done by hand, using materials that could only be brought in by helicopter. So I spoke to the strict regulatory oversight throughout permitting and operation, and now I'd like to describe how that doesn't stop when a mine closes. In fact, the mine's plan for reclamation and closure, it's mandated by law, has to be approved by the DNR commissioner before operations are allowed to begin. And in addition to getting the approval of the reclamation plan, mines have to provide financial assurance in the event that reclamation obligations can't be performed. Financial assurance requirements apply to all companies, regardless of where they're headquartered, and all mines, regardless of land ownership. Financial assurance guarantees are reviewed every 5 years or earlier if necessary, and that's a system that's also unique to Alaska. So here's a side-by-side.
Wait a minute. I think Joe Sr. was doing reclamation work before it was ever a requirement by anybody. Senator Giesel?
Well, I'll just add to that, Mr. Co-Chair. So I talked to Joe Iusibelli, the son of the mine founder, and they actually collect native seeds from the trees around the area, give school kids paper bags, and they go around and collect pine cones and birch seed and all of that, spread it out in the conference rooms to dry. Then they send it off to a place that plants it, makes the little seedling things, and then they go around planting. It's really remarkable what they do. So all of this reclamation is with native local plants. Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Well, Mr. and Madam Co-Chair, you teed me up beautifully to tell you about these two photos here. This is a side-by-side comparison of reclamation that was done at Iusibelli in 2016. And yes, I have to tell you that really is a photo on the left taken in January. It's a very windy area. It was a low snow year. And so that I promise you that was taken in January 2016. And the point here is to show you how effective Iusibelli's reclamation. Just 6 months went by between those two photos, and you can see the recontouring of the land. You can see impressive vegetation cover. And for a lot of the reasons that Madam Co-Chair Giesel just detailed, they've got a great system there and have figured out how to do very successful reclamation there at Iusibelli.
Senator Klemas, excuse me.
Since we're taking a break for questions, I want to turn back briefly to the page that shows, I think, the 8 mines that are actively operating. I guess now it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the six mines with a star on the map. And I know we've been having all these discussions about the 404 permitting. Of those mines, were those places that would have, even if we assumed 404, would we still have to have a federal permit because of where they are in relation to waters of the United States? If you know.
Then you can get back to the committee if you don't.
So, Senator Klayman, through the chair, and I may look to Mike as a representative in actual mine, we would certainly be happy to go back and get you a list of what would and what would not have been when these came into production. I know you've gotten presentations from DEC so far that have talked about those retained waters in which Alaska would not have jurisdiction. So it just...
But I'm more intrigued. Yeah, my curiosity is just, were these mines that were actually in a location? Because I know mining always requires water. It's not a dry operation, so I was just curious where these that are actually in operation, where they fit in that rubric. But you can get back to us, that'd be great.
Okay. Beg your pardon, let me go forward.
Yep, we'll go back to where we were.
Excuse me. So now I'd like to show you a view of the reclamation that was done post-mine, so after mine closure. Yes, what you're looking at here was a mine. This is a look at the True North Mine that was mined by Kinross, Alaska. And I think the quote from former Commissioner Feige really sums up the common goal between state and industry. We produced the minerals that we needed from this area. We provided great jobs and economic and community benefits. And then after mining, the land was restored to an ideal condition for future uses. This is exactly what our system was designed to do, and there are ideal outcomes to boast about across the state. So from an environmental perspective, we know that mining can and is being done right in our state. So now I'd like to look at the benefits to the people. Most people think of a local mine as creating good jobs that pay state and local taxes and help fund public services. And while that's all true, there is a lot more that can make a difference in our communities, whether it's vocational training, whether it's supporting Alaska businesses, support for nonprofits, or promoting that culture of safety and teaching skills that get passed on at home and in our communities. So each year, Karen's group, the Council of Alaska Producers and AMA, commissioned the McKinley Group to do a study of the economic and community benefits of Alaska. We're in the process of finalizing that, and we've got some great 2022 data, but again, referring to the map handout you have, and on the screen here, these white dots, this is one of the most major points I'd like to leave you here with today, is the regional impact that comes from mining. You can see the small dots throughout the state. Those are the over 90 communities in which mining industry employees live. In many cases, areas of rural Alaska where there aren't a lot of other economic opportunities. That regional impact, as you can see, really spread across the state and provide those good jobs. And Alaska mines support Alaska's businesses. In 2022 alone, our mines and projects spent $1 billion on goods and services from over 450 Alaska companies. These range from the small businesses that you can see on the screen here to large businesses. And the photo on the right is a powerhouse module that was built in Anchorage and sent to the Red Dog mine. Red Dog also had crew quarters fabricated at its facility in Big Lake and sent to the mine. Getting into those training opportunities and jobs for Alaskans, which is certainly a hot topic today, we really want Alaskan miners, and we invest in education and training opportunities to make that happen. Mining companies directly employ 5,700 people currently. That's a hot off the press number. And that's a person that's working at a mine site. So that's 5,700 direct at a mine site. And there's 11,400 direct and indirect jobs that come from people working for companies that provide services to mines. So whether it's transportation or engineering or camp services, environmental, you name it. So over 11,000 total mining industry workers in Alaska. And these are good jobs. These are mostly year-round. They pay an average of $130,000 a year. That's almost twice the average salary in Alaska. And they're jobs that can support families in the Alaska lifestyle.
Senator Kawasaki, I'm sorry.
Thanks. I have a question. We met earlier to talk about this, but we got the most recent numbers for non-resident workers, especially in this industry in particular. I don't have that sheet in front of me, but I've got some 2019 numbers. It seems to show that 37% or so are non-residents. What are ways that the industry is trying to do to improve those numbers and sort of enhance Alaskan hire? And the question can go to anybody. Thanks.
For the record, Karen Mathias, Council of Alaska Producers. This is something we spend a lot of time thinking about, and I know at the companies they do too. It makes sense to hire Alaskans. They're used to the state. Their families are used to being here. They stay longer. They're good workers. And so, one of the things that the companies have been doing for many, many years is investing in vocational training opportunities through the university, even some K-12 programs. Mike will be able to speak more specifically about, for example, the Delta Junction Mine Underground Mine Training Center. The three underground mines in Alaska, Pogo, Greens Creek, and Kensington, all use this training center that's operated by MAPS under the university. And they give conditional employment offers. And so if you're interested in a job in mining, you can go through this six-week program, and you can come out and you have a job at one of the three underground mines.
there's also a real effort to make sure there's awareness so that people in high school know that these are career options. So there's various ways that they pursue to reach out to, in some cases, middle school or high school level to show that there's more than just one job in the mining industry. One of our former general managers used to talk about, you know, that each, certainly at the remote camps, they're like small villages. So you name a job in a community and it may well exist at one of the mining camps. So it might be EMT, it might be food services, it could be accounting or warehouse or logistics, in addition, of course, to truck driver and underground miner and you know, the people who work, the millwrights and people who work in the mill. So there's a real effort to raise awareness about the educational opportunities. But there are challenges, and it's not just a challenge for our industry. Senate Labor and Commerce just had a hearing last week with a number of industries saying very similar things, which is that, you know, the out-migration of young working-level people in Alaska is affecting all of our industries. And they're not leaving because they can't find a good job, because we have jobs available. So why are they leaving? Why do they want to live somewhere else? This is something that one industry can't solve. It's going to take the state and municipalities to look at all of those issues that I know many of you have already heard about, whether it's housing or childcare or, you know, whatever the challenges are that are keeping people from staying in the state, because we would prefer to have Alaskans in those jobs.
Thank you.
Mike, I think you and I worked on some of this going back in 2007. When we brought the mining industry into the Department of Labor as a group and went down this pathway and started some of the first ever registered apprenticeship programs for exploratory drilling and warehoused it in Kotzebue. It's a tough business. You'll never get me working underground. I can guarantee you that. I want to do all the mining with the sun shining on my back. But we've made a good effort, and the Delta Mine Training Center is a good example of some of that stuff we started 15 years ago.
For the record, Diantha Skabinski, AMA. Chairman Bishop, this time of year, underground is really lovely. It's very pleasant.
Sure, do I get a tan underground?
So now switching to transitioning to the benefits to Alaska Native corporations. There's a lot of data on this slide, and it's good and important data, but it really doesn't do justice to the positive impact in partnerships between Alaska Native corporations and mining. For example, the $1.7 billion in royalties that has gone from the Red Dog mine and shared amongst the 12 regional corporations since 1989 and subsequently shared with the village corporations. For many village corporations, this has been their primary source of income. So these payments have contributed to all Native corporations in Alaska and really, as a result, has benefited every corner of the state. There's also the focus on shareholder employment. In the 1980s, NANA negotiated an agreement for Red Dog, ensuring that not only would the region benefit from the royalties at the mine, but there would also be jobs for shareholders. And today, of the more than 600 jobs at the mine, more than 50% are NANA shareholder hire, are NANA shareholders that work there. Because they've been operating since 1989, there are some third-generation employees there. Another good example is the Donlin Gold Project. During their exploration phase, their local hire rate was over 90%. So great job and shareholder placement activity within our industry. And then there are the business partnerships that I referred to a couple slides ago, in which corporations, business corporations that are underneath Native corporations oftentimes are formed in conjunction with a mine coming online to provide goods and services to that mine, like the NANA construction of the Red Dog food quarters, et cetera. And finally, the long-term community partnerships that come from mining, it's the giving back. So in 2022, mining provided $4.5 million in charitable contributions to nonprofits in Alaska. And that's just from the companies themselves. It doesn't take into account what the miners give personally in terms of, you know, their personal charitable contributions and activities. Miners are coaches, and they are volunteers, and they are your neighbors. And with that, I will turn it back over to Karen. Thank you again.
For the record, Karen Mathias, Council of Alaska Producers. So we have a few slides on government revenue from mining. And first, it's important to distinguish between taxes and royalties. Taxes are paid to the government. Could be local government, could be state government. Royalties are paid to the landowner. And in Alaska, for our current mines, the landowner could be the state, the Alaska Mental Health Trust. It could be the federal government or one of the Native corporations. Well, for our current mines, it is a Native corporation. But there is only one mine, Pogo, one metal mine, that is on state land entirely, and our only coal mine in Alaska is on state land. So as a result, the state is only getting royalties from those two mines that are entirely on state land, and a very small amount, because often land ownership is a bit of a patchwork. But the point is that royalties are not the largest category of revenue for the state. This slide shows us the categories for revenues to the state and to state agencies for 2022. And these numbers came from the McKinley Research Group. I encourage you to also look at the state numbers, which are published annually in full in the annual mineral industry report that's produced by DNR's Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. It's a great report in general as a resource about mining in Alaska. It covers everything from the mines themselves and the projects, production, job numbers, and revenue. And they have a table fairly early on that breaks it down into all the different categories. And this is important because the revenue sources book groups, you know, non-oil corporate income tax as one amount. And so they don't pull out, you know, mining. So you can't use the revenue sources book to really get a picture of mining revenue. But the DGGS table, which gets information from the Department of Revenue and also from DNR, because they receive the royalties and the rents, and, the material sales, et cetera, that gives you a state look at all of the ways that mining contributes to the state. And the other thing I really like about that table, and I would have shown it to you, I would have used those numbers, but the latest report should be out soon, I would think, because last year it came out at about this time, but it's not available yet. So when it is, I hope you'll have a look at it. One of the things about that table is that they give 5 or 6 years' worth of revenue numbers. And with mining, because commodity prices are volatile, you can have years that are better or worse than others. And so if we just give a snapshot of 1 year, it might, you know, it might be cherry picking. It might not give you that overall view. Whereas if you look at all of those years, you could get a better idea of what the average is.
On that point, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think on the Red Dog expansion, if they go forward, that's going to be on state land underground. So states should get some royalty. We'll get royalty.
Mr. Chairman, you are absolutely right. They are looking at expanding onto state land. So from the state's point of view, the more mining on state land, the more revenue to the state directly.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Klein,
he's studying, I think. The state can collect corporate income tax, but unlike oil, where we actually have a production tax as it's produced, there's in the mining industry, we currently have not authorized the collection of production of minerals. We get royalties, we get corporate income tax as state revenue.
Senator Klayman, through the chairs, that top line is the Alaska Mining License Tax. So all mines in Alaska pay, and the large mines pay the top tier, which is 7%, which is the in addition to corporate tax and royalties.
Follow up.
What's the 7% based on?
Senator Klayman, through the chairs, net income.
Thank you.
So the next slide is a slide that came from a study that the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage published. And they also looked at an average of, in this case, 4 years. The previous study, they did five. Obviously, 2020 was a strange year for some industries in terms of revenue during the pandemic, so they decided to cap it at 2016 to 2019. The bar on the left-hand side, the bottom of it is state revenue, and the top adds on the local revenue. So for those 4 years, the average was just under $100 million. On the right-hand side are the state expenses for managing the mining industry. And you can see, and then on top of that is the capital budget funds that were expended on mining as an average in those 4 years. And you can see that the difference between the two is significant, which means there was a net benefit to the state from revenue that came from mining. One of the reasons for that small state expenses is because of the reimbursable service agreements. So most of the large mines and the large projects enter into agreements with the Office for Project Management and Permitting under DNR, which coordinates permits for expansions at existing operations or for new projects. And those costs by OPUMP and the other state agencies are then billed back to the companies. So the cost is not coming out of the UGF, it's being paid by the company, it's being billed to the companies and paid by the companies. As you saw on the last slide, for 2022, it included state payments to, I'll show you, to the bottom four are state agencies. So I just took the actual taxes, royalties, and the other types of payments, like the material sales and other payments to DNR. And that number is $95 million. If you add in the $55 million in 2022 that the mines paid to local government, it equals $150 million in 2022. So you can see that's a significant increase from the four-year average of just under $100 million between 2016 and 2019. In terms of those local tax payments, mines are the largest taxpayers, single taxpayers in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, in the City and Borough of Juneau, and also in the Northwest Arctic Borough. The important thing about local taxes is that they are a very predictable, reliable source of revenue to local governments. They don't change on, depending on commodity prices. They are a set, mill rate, and so the local governments can budget accordingly.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, my name is Mike Satry with Hecla Mining Company. Deantha and Karen have done a fantastic job of laying out the current state of the mining industry in Alaska, and they're always a very tough act to follow. I was brought in here today to give a little bit of the company perspective on some of the things that are facing us here in Alaska, and maybe I'll back up and start with a little bit more of an introduction. I've been in the mining industry for over 27 years now. I started out as a mine geologist and spent more than a few years working underground, and we'll always have a friendly rivalry with our co-chair. But I look back on those days fondly, and hopefully you get a chance to tour an underground mine in the very near future. I think you'll enjoy it. But a few years ago, I started taking on external affairs role, and certainly have worked with all of you, almost all of you in the past, and look forward to working with you as you go forward. I work for Hecla Mining Company. Hecla is an American mining company. We've been around for 130 years now. Our corporate offices are in Idaho and Coeur d'Alene. We have operating mines in Alaska, Idaho, and Quebec. We just bought some properties in the Yukon, and we have some other properties in Nevada, Montana, and scattered across the country. So we take a very long-term look at metals and mineral space, and I think we find it absolutely amazing that today there's a greater recognition that that minerals really power not only our present, but our future. I mean, we've always known that as a mining company, but now the general public seems to recognize that, and the policymakers seem to recognize that. Each day we seem to find new and innovative ways to use minerals to power the technologies that make our daily lives possible. Whether it's minerals that most people have never heard of, like germanium or gallium, or if it's a mineral that we produce at Hecla, like silver, and we produce 40% of the U.S. supply of silver. 30% of the U.S. supply comes from right here at Greens Creek, here in Juneau. But, silver is now critical to the manufacturing of solar panels. And so minerals are just integrated into our daily lives like never before. So what does this mean for Alaska? I think I've helped participate in these CAP and AMA updates for many, many years. And we have always said that Alaska has unlimited mineral potential. And we still do. To underscore that potential, I put a little snippet of a map put out by DGGS that shows mineral occurrences and prospects throughout the state. Not here to necessarily talk about the details there. Just look for the noise in the map. You see all the different placer districts. You see the points representing different prospects, really throughout the state of Alaska. And it represents just about every single element known to man is found here, right here in Alaska in some way, shape, or form. But the ultimate question is going to be, do we have enough of these minerals to form an economic ore deposit? And do we have the wherewithal as an industry and a state to develop it? I mean, how do we go from being America's mineral warehouse to America's mineral powerhouse? So what is our pathway to mineral prosperity of the state? You know, we've talked in the presentation today that we only have five large metal mines. We have one coal mine. We certainly have a very healthy placer industry. But what do we do to turn those dots on the map into operating mines that provide the regional benefits that Deanta and Aaron talked about today? Well, let's remember that mineral development and mining do not happen overnight. So let's take Greens Creek as an example. Greens Creek was discovered in 1973. It took from 1973 to 1989, 16 years, to get that from first discovery into production. The mine then operated, and it took until 2006 until we got to cumulative net positive cash flow. So that investment that started in 1973 was able to open the mine 16 years later, and then took till 2006 to really truly start to be in a free cash flow situation in the mining industry. So time is a critical component to making these mines happen. There's no easy button to develop our resources. So what else do mines need besides time here in Alaska to be successful? Well, if you look at our existing mines, there are some common characteristics. Most of them are world class in terms of either their size, their tonnage, or their grade, the tenor, the amount of material that's contained, within the rock. So they're world class in terms of grade and tonnage. They also have access to infrastructure, whether that be a port, a road, power. Having access to infrastructure is critical to allowing a mine to develop and go forward. So how do we get there? There's more than just the mineral deposit, the access, the infrastructure, the company's will to bring this mine into production. I think if we look at lessons learned over the years, there's a few things on the slide in front of you that we need to make sure that we're working towards and working on. One is community support. There's no question that the existing mines in Alaska have overwhelming community support. We see that in statewide polling, and we also see that in socioeconomic surveys that all the mines do. Those mines have been integrated into their communities. As Deanta discussed, the miners are your neighbor, they're the coaches of the kids' soccer team, they're involved in citywide committees. They're integral to the community, and the communities have started to take ownership of those mines as well. They're just part of the fabric of daily life. But we also know that community support is sometimes lacking for new operations. And there's always the fear of the unknown when it comes to bringing a new operation in production. In my career, I've seen a big change in the mining industry in terms of how we get out and try and get out in front of that. Do community engagement, at the beginning of the process, at the exploration process, bring people in, listen to their concerns, try to make sure that we operate in a transparent fashion and move to something that community, that region can agree on and move forward. We're not perfect at that yet, but we're doing much better now than we did when I started working in the mining industry. So we as an industry have to work to continue to build that community support. And we also need the communities that we've been working in to continue to defend what we're trying to do as well. We also need to look at infrastructure partnerships. If the potential for a mine is large enough, companies will take on the infrastructure development, the capital investment that needs to be done to make it happen. you know, whether that's building our ports, building roads where we have the ability to build, you know, to permit and build those roads, building, you know, power plants, we will do that. But there can be a greater long-term benefit to a community, to a region, if we're able to leverage mining as that building block for development in the greater area. And Juneau is a great example of this. When you look at the hydroelectric facilities in Juneau, whether it's Salmon Creek Dam, which is also our freshwater, one of our freshwater basins, and some of the other smaller hydroelectric facilities, those were built to support the AJ Treadwell mines back in the day, and they're still here, you know, providing the community of Juneau with power. Greens Creek Mine, we originally built the mine with diesel-generated power, but we had the ability to move forward the development of the Sweetheart Lake facility, the AAMP had, move that forward in production much further than our community growth would have allowed for. So Greens Creek became a surplus customer of AELMP. Sweetheart Lake was able to be developed, and we have a surplus power agreement where we are obligated to buy all the surplus power from that facility, and that allows hydroelectric power to be provided to the city of Juneau. We've saved the citizens of Juneau over $70 million since that came into play in 2006, because that capital investment did not have to go to the normal ratepayers. It was taken up by the large industrial facility that is Greens Creek. So that's an example of one of those infrastructure partnerships that can work. You've all heard the story about the road that Ada has for the Red Dog Mine, which has been a very successful investment over the years. There's another great example of a partnership that private industry and a government corporation has been able to come together to facilitate mining industry development going forward. Talked about the length of time it takes to permit a mine, so it becomes even more important when we're looking at making these investments that we have both a stable fiscal regime and a stable regulatory regime. We can't see the rules. If we're going to make long-term investments, if we're going to take 16 years from exploration to production, we can't see big changes in taxation, policy coming at the mining industry, because we have to have some certainty as to what's facing us when we do get into production, that we can account for that in the mine that we're trying to develop. We also want to see that on the regulatory side. We're not afraid of environmental standards getting higher as technology allows us to do that. That's just part of the process. We meet a high environmental standard. We'll continue to meet a high environmental standard going forward, but it's the processes that we need to see that stability, the ability to get through a process, to be able to, you know, get out of, and we've seen this in other jurisdictions, endless cycles of litigation that never allow a project to move forward, because you're continually having to go back and redo the permitting pathway that's been laid out. So stability on the fiscal side, stability on the regulatory side is incredibly important to the mining industry. If we're able to do all this, we may see some more mines come into Alaska. But, you know, if you look back over the last couple of decades, from 2001 to 2010, $1.8 billion was spent on exploration in the state. During that time, two mines opened up, Pogo Mine and the Kensington Mine. Now, those were certainly, you know, exploration and development was already underway before they came into production that decade. From 2011 to 2020, and these are DGGS numbers, another $1.6 billion in exploration was spent in the state of Alaska. No new mines have opened during that time. So we have to continue to be able to attract those exploration dollars into Alaska if we're going to be able to provide, take the minerals that Alaska has, produce those in an environmentally responsible manner, shore up our mineral supply chains here in the United States, and be able to provide the minerals that we need in our daily lives that we can produce right here in the state. So look forward to working with all of you on that as we go forward. And before I close, I know that this committee has a planned tour of the Kensington Gold Mine here in Juneau in April, and I hope you all can make it. There's nothing like visiting a mine. We can talk about it all we want here in the room, show you pretty pictures, but getting on the ground and talking to the workforce about what they do and how they do it's incredibly important. I'm used to coming in front of you and talking to you about how mining works, but when you talk to the operators and you realize that the skill that they have to do their job, the pride that they have in doing their job properly is absolutely amazing to them. So I urge you to talk to them and find out what they do, how they do it, how they protect the environment, and how that allows them to live here in Alaska doing the job that they do every day. There will always be questions about the mining industry. Deantha and Karen are fantastic resources. They, on speed dial, they have all the mining experts in the state. They can always get the answer that they need to provide you the best information to make good mining policy in the future. So please use them as a resource. But I also want to highlight that next week, both the AMA and the Council of Alaska Producers are hosting a mining forum here in Juneau. We have a fantastic panel of mining experts and policy experts that will be there. Many of the legislators in this building are moderating the panels, and it's going to be a fantastic educational opportunity for everybody. We hope to see you there. Thank you for your time this afternoon, and I think all three of us are ready to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Kaufman, sir.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I've been quiet for so long, my voice quit working. Through the chair to either of our panelists that might feel like answering. When I look at the map of opportunities, both present and future, and the integration that was just discussed around how the public-private partnership works, is there at this point adequate planning being done in the sense of that anyone who's looking at the big picture in a way that would end up with, we have the Trans-Alaska pipeline for petroleum. Do we have a good conceptual pipeline for minerals development delivery, which might even include some value-added activities? It's a shame to ship everything out. And I know that with rare earths, that it's one thing to have them and to mine them. The other, as far as refining them, that's a real tough spot, especially in the United States. I think we had one refining opportunity in Nevada that was shut down, and maybe they're trying to start it back up. So kind of the big picture in the strategic plan for minerals development and delivery in Alaska, what's the state of planning around that to identify all the interfaces, the infrastructure needs, the high potential targets that we need to focus on first, getting them running, in planning, what are the prerequisites that we need to have, and what sympathetic elements do we have to have, let's see what I did there, elements, working with each other to really deliver some of this opportunity. Long question, sorry for all that, but that's what I've got. Thank you.
All right, so Mike Satcher for the record, through the chair, Senator Kaufman. That is a long, wonderful question, and probably we could spend hours going through all of that. When we talk about value added, it's interesting to look at the mining industry that at least currently we are not, say, as vertically integrated as the petroleum industry. And so the miners tend to be just the miners. And there's no, we sell our concentrates or our Doré bars, whatever it is, to the refiners and the smelters, and that's the end of our involvement. There potentially could be opportunity for refining, processing, value added, but that's a conversation that has to be had with the folks who are experts in those areas. But there's a couple things that they're going to need. One is probably port access to worldwide markets, because there's not enough in Alaska right now to, say, support a smelter or a refiner, whether that be for traditional metals or that to be, rare earths or some of the new things that we're just working on figuring out new uses for. They also need access to power. Power is an incredible piece of that. In northern British Columbia, there's an aluminum smelter, and the only reason that there's an aluminum smelter there is because they built a dam and have hydropower, and they bring alumina from all over the world into northern BC at Kitimat, refine it, and then ship it out. So power is a key consideration there. When we look at planning, ultimately, I think it starts with our industry, with the industry as it is today, with land management plans on both the state and federal side, and recognizing that there's mineral potential throughout, and how how do we balance, you know, areas of high mineral potential with high ecological value? I think there's great pathways to being able to extract those minerals yet still preserve those values. We operate in a national monument on Admiralty Island, and I think that's a great example of how that can be done responsibly over time. So it starts with that land management planning, but realizing that mineral potential has to be a key piece of that. And I think long term, and this gets tougher, but getting, whether it's the mineral industry, the petroleum industry, fishing, tourism, you know, all of the industry groups in Alaska together, where do we need roads? Is rail appropriate in some areas? Do we need access? Do we need power? Do we need ports? And just having representatives of all industries at the table there, because some of these things that we need aren't just unique to our industry, they're needed for our communities and all other industries here in Alaska.
Just wanted to add, from the state point of view, there, you know, in different administrations, there have been various economic development assessment efforts that have involved mining as well as other industries, obviously. That I think the challenge for the state is that administrations change and priorities change. But from the industry point of view, the Alaska Minerals Commission has existed for a lot longer than I've been doing this. And they have an annual report which has priorities. And if you look at those reports over the years, you will see, Chair Bishop has it right there. You'll see commonalities. And so that is an example of the mining industry identifying specifically, you know, what's missing in order for the industry to be robust. I'd also say that the efforts to bring roads to resources that have been undertaken by various administrations is a long-term vision of opening areas of Alaska to mineral resource development.
Senator Klayman.
You made reference to world-class mines and noted that pretty much all the mines on the map in operation are world-class mines. Is there a easily obtained definition of world-class mines that one could find?
Mike Satry, for the record. I'll take that because I think I'd lean on that one a bit. No. There, when you look, you know, companies would tend to have their internal evaluation systems for, say, a Tier 1 or a Tier 2 or a Tier 3 asset, and there's some generally accepted industry standards for, you know, how large a gold mine or how large a lead zinc mine has to be to be up there. But I think from a you know, qualitative perspective, when you look at you know, Red Dog is one of the largest zinc mines in the world. Greens Creek is one of the largest silver producers in the world. You know, Fort Knox, in terms of size, it's low grade but very large. And this, you know, True North and Gill Shawnee deposits, you know, that district is known worldwide and has a, you know, significant volume to it. You know, Pogo has been described as a Tier 1 gold asset. So it just takes that amount of mineral in the ground, that potential economic value to support the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars today, to get that into production, especially given, you know, the young infrastructure the state has and what that project would have to do to build out their own infrastructure or partner with state or local governments to do that.
Short follow-up.
It sounds like any mine today that gets developed in Alaska, given the long time horizon between discovery, exploration, permitting, you're really looking at a 40 to 50 year project for it to be successful. And it sounds like pretty much any mine that comes along today is going to fit in what you would, a Tier 1 or a world-class mine, because you just have to have a certain amount of the resource to justify the investment and the expense to start pulling the resource out.
Through the chair, yes. I mean, that's a good way of looking at it. You know, there. If you look at, you know, for example, the Donlin deposit, if that was on I-80 in Nevada, we've been mining that for the last 20 years. and it would have been much easier to develop. But it's in, you know, remote rural Alaska and has, you know, a lot of infrastructure that has to be developed moving forward, and they're doing a great job of trying to move that forward. So, you know, there's no question that ability to access power, access roads, access ports is one of those key things that allows a prospect to go forward.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Giesel.
I only have a comment, Mr. Chairman. It's not always a company that comes in and says, oh, let's develop a mine here. We see resources. I'm going to call out the Manh Choh under development here on our map. So this is on property owned by the village of Tetlin. And the chief of that village looked at the poverty in this very small village and said, you know, we must have resources here. And so he invited in oil geologists. And they came in and explored, and they came back to the village council and said, well, we've got good news and we got bad news. So the bad news is, sorry, no oil. The good news is, gold. You should have some miners come in and check this out. So they did. And they have a significant amount of that mineral. So you see, it's under development. And it's brought great wealth to this tiny, very poor village, bringing in GED courses, because a lot of these kids had not graduated from high school. The adults had not either. And those adults had an opportunity to get a high school diploma because of what this company brought in. They've sent some of the kids to college. They've gotten skills for the mine. I mean, that's, to me, as a lifelong Alaskan, that's the huge value that this kind of development brings. So just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I'll wrap up with, and that was only 12, that deposit's only 12 miles off the road system. So, USGS in 2012 did a presentation at the University of Alaska and said, Alaska is 50 years behind in knowing what we have for assets. We're that underexplored. Go ahead.
I just can't help myself, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The USGS has also spent, and the rest of the United States, over $900 million in advancing the mineral opportunities in Afghanistan, but very little here. So we've got a long ways to go. So I'm glad they recognize we have potential.
Thank you. We're going to close for today. We want to thank our presenters, and there is no meeting this Friday, and the next meeting is Monday, March 6th at 3:30 p.m. We are adjourned.